Okay, good morning. I think we'll just get started and let others sort of join us as we go. I am Carol Ha. I'm curator of contemporary art here at the Freer and Sackler. And I'm very pleased to introduce Rina Banerjee. She is the featured artist for our upcoming Perspective series, which amazingly has been going on for 10 years. We're in our 10th year. And so what a wonderful way to celebrate that landmark with Rina. Rina Banerjee, briefly, is based in New York, where she lives and works. She originally did her undergraduate studies in polymer engineering and worked as a polymer chemist until she decided to go to Yale, where she received her MFA in painting and sculpture. She really came to prominence when she was included in the Whitney Biennial in 2000, and since then there have been numerous exhibitions. She's been showing work all over the world, and in fact currently she has an installation up at Glassdress at the Palazzo Franchetti in Venice, and she'll have some shows coming up this fall in New York and Tokyo. So in this very busy schedule, we're honored to have Rina here, where I think the format of this morning will be quite informal. We'll have a bit of Rina will describe and describe her work and talk about this installation, and then we'll have a bit of a conversation and open it out to all of you for questions. Some of the very sort of brief logistics here. It would be preferable when you go up to see the work to sort of stay around the edges. It's a work that's still in progress. We still have a few elements that hopefully we'll be adding today. And then there are some very delicate pieces, and these smaller objects are not attached or adhered to the floor in any way. So I do ask you to be cautious when you look at the work. It will be up through June of next year. So during that time, we hope to have some programming. Rina, hopefully, will be back in the spring for a conversation. Also in October, we have a couple of special exhibitions opening up. Yoga, the Art of Transformation, and Strange and Wondrous, prints from the Robert Del Bonta collection. And so please do come back. There will be an interesting opportunity to look at all three exhibitions and consider points of convergence, ways of thinking about, particularly in the late 19th century and into the early 20th century, to our very globalized present, the effects or the impact or the long history of cultural contact and the transformations that ensue. So please do come back. We also hope to have a panel discussion working through or somehow addressing some issues surrounding ecological issues in Asia, water and environment, sustainability issues. So I will let Rina, though, tease out some more of all of the rich associations and references and the symbolism that is embedded within this work. So with that, Rina?
Thank you, and thank you for welcoming me here at the Sackler. It's been a very important experience as an artist to be able to speak to the issues of Asia and where Asia is today. One of the things that is very important in my work is to stitch together my own personal history here as an American and also the experience of migration, which continues to be an important thread in my work from the beginning. How that beginning changed and formed into different sculptures and different subject matter is also very important in its evolution and how it's become layered. What remains instinctually for me very important is the diversity of subject matter that can be connected as an artist, as I see it in my experience. The Sackler Commission allowed me to think about where we are historically, what I'd like to do here in DC, the location of the sculpture, and the specific site, which is this museum and its collection. I had a relationship with the museum and have been watching it grow and develop for over 6 years now. And so I'd had the unique pleasure to learn of Arthur Sackler and his motivation for his collection, which is very much an anchor in my mind for how you address a site location piece. When Carol invited me to choose and to form an idea around the one sculpture that would be in the pavilion, my initial reaction was, I want to do something that really talks about the environment. And very specifically, I'm considering the environment in Asia. Growing up and being born in Calcutta, I had the specific experience of learning what the Ganges means to my mother, and fond memories of visiting, but also a kind of recollection of the difficulty that water places on us in terms of our responsibility to keep it clean, but also make it available. And in addressing that issue, I came across a number of experiences most recently that addresses climate control. And I don't know if many of you have been following Hurricane Sandy that happened in New York. We had an evacuation of 9 days where we could see the sea coming in towards the high risers that I was living in. And in that moment, it was very clear the connections we have to the rest of the world, which is this water that surrounds every place in the world that is very much an impact on our climate, but also our livelihood, our commerce, our engagement in migration, making possible all the shipping and the manufacturing that goes along the rivers to make it possible to have drinking water, to make it possible to run these big buildings and the urban sites that are sprouts among what we call the ports of civilization, the ports of commerce. I began to make the piece in a way that allowed me to address the kinds of materials I am involved in my past, and some of those things really reflect on these ideas about what is the beginning, what is the origin, mythology, what are the stories that we tell ourselves make into history. The fabrication of the sculpture then realizes the materials that I will be using, and that becomes a starting point. If you look at the sculpture, you'll see the dome, and the dome is a recurring symbol in my work. It symbolizes for me a kind of housing that is particularly more present in the past versus the present. It is both ancient, classical, and at the same time, it is a kind of shape that is recurring in architecture that references the body, the head, the temple. I've done a number of sculptures regarding this particular dome. It changes in shape, orientation, placement. This is the first time I've made the dome upside down in Flemish painting and in the Middle Ages. An upside down funnel would represent clearly madness. So I bring to the conversation ideas about madness. Madness is sometimes referenced in ways we take risk, how we manage the future, how we allow change. So those are the positive things about madness. When you encounter a crossing, a transformation, if you will. Certainly, madness is about crisis, it's about war, it's about nature, the chaos in nature. So in this piece, I reference that kind of madness. It also has in its form the ability to imagine if the dome represents the mountain, perhaps the Himalayas, that if it becomes upside down as it is seen before you, that it allows the water to run out. One of the things that I was considering is the problematic situation where we have the mountains and the ice caps on those mountains becoming no longer available to collect water and to drain water through those mountains into major Asian rivers. And those rivers feed 40% of the drinking water in the world. That's a major source of our water. And in referencing that, I have this idea of that water running out, and then what you see on the floor, a kind of trail of materials, both small and hand size and scale, that run across the floor to create a symbolic river, a river that represents all water. What is special about the river is its connection to the land, unlike the ocean. It has this presence of being a divide, a splitting between one land and the other. So there's a lot of symbolic dualism that goes into making the work and placing the materials and choosing the scale with which I work with. I think the other thing that, the other object that I chose is the scale of justice, which Carol yesterday in our conversation pointed out also is the scale we measure things and create commerce, a place of exchange. One of the things that I wanted to do is create this sense of moral, ethical, and psychological experience that you have when thinking about not only water, but how we exchange in terms of value, how we place value, and how that value changes with our growth and our evolution as a larger culture.
It's, I think, it's fascinating to see the different characters actually that come out of this work. There is a tendency in your work to create these juxtapositions, and there are numerous ways to look at this. And one sort of general tension I see is that there's this very pleasing element of materiality. There's the shiny, there's the rough, there's the sort of small, large, all gathered together in this kind of imagined world, in this imagined geography. At the same time, and with the elements of color, but at the same time, the use of black horns, the use of these sharp shapes, the now uncovered dome and the wire frame underneath. It's really, there's another feeling there, perhaps, of danger is a little too strong, but perhaps a certain darker aspect to, perhaps, our relationship to nature, some of the consequences of the commerce that runs across the rivers, some of the consequences of our sort of will to extract value from nature. When I see the scale and the gold brick and think of water, of course, as you mentioned, you think of alchemy. So this constant long history of interacting with nature, of living in it and around it, of extracting value from it, has some negative consequences as well. So I think it's fascinating the way you have arranged these juxtapositions, and there are others, I'm sure, that I'm missing yet.
Yeah. So. Well, I think horns do come up in many cultures, certainly Italy, Asia. This is a replica, the black horns that you see behind me is a replica of the American buffalo, which comes out of a lot of Native American mythology. But in essence, the horn in its physicality has a kind of sharpness that refers to the battle that these beasts take on to protect themselves. It creates a sense of fear in most people as we have these kind of animal fights. So there is this kind of power associated with it, but it's also behind that power, our desire for power has to do with more with fear, the fear of the unknown. And definitely darkness has the pleasure of being both promising in the way I see it in terms of engaging what could be, what hasn't happened yet, without light in the darkness. But it also has this sense of risk and fear of the future. And you do take these risks in real life because you have to. And how you take them on is very important. I use horns throughout my work, both in my drawings and paintings, as well as in my sculpture. And they reference various things, not one thing. And it's always important to realize that objects, in the way that I would be using them, can reference multiple cultures, multiple things, and symbolize any one of those things that could be in that vocabulary.
And just to follow up on that point, you've mentioned, you've often described how each of the materials you choose, it's not simply their material qualities, but where they come from and how you acquire them is something that you consider carefully as well.
Yeah. I mean, when I was started out with sculpture maybe 15 years ago, I think there was a kind of leaning for me to use materials that I thought were very authentic, sincere. So people would see some of the materials I would use and say, well, this is from India, because you're Indian, you're using it. Or this is from the US because you live here and therefore using it. And it occurred to me that I wanted to expand my vocabulary to those places that I enjoy and learn from and are natural to the environment that I am. Growing up in New York, I grew up in Queens, and in Queens I was exposed to Jamaicans, Koreans, South Asians, the Irish, the Italians, and all these neighborhoods. And in learning about the people that were in my community, I became aware of the use of the materials. And in a sense, we never really come to the point where we legitimize those experiences because we think of them as inauthentic, that those experiences cannot then resonate as part of your own collected identity. Art is a place where we collect. We collect the materials that make the work. Collectors collect the art that make them feel their own identity. Museums take interest in the work that suggests their subject matter, their mission. And in some sense, we have the power to fabricate our own culture, and our culture can be connected to other places. I'm very interested in China. I'm very interested in Japan and Korea, my neighbors that make up Asia. I'm interested in Aboriginal art specifically. I'm very moved in my work with oceanic work, Hawaiian, those things that I saw at the Met growing up. Were my favorite rooms. I am a tourist in that sense. My education was not in India. It was American, and it had very little interest in oceanic work. So it was something that I had to journey into for my personal satisfaction. I use feathers in this work, which really comes out of my interest in Africa and the oceanic cultures, Philippines. So those things, in some sense, cannot be legitimized by only knowing my history of where I was born and maybe where I will pass and where my studio is. And so to share that in your work is a very important communication you can't have if you just look in the internet and find out my work. So what I am able to do in the sculpture is bring those interests in, not to really kind of divulge to you what is China, what is Africa, but what parts of those worlds interest me. So it's a kind of fabrication, invention, and creation of your own individual identity.
I think that's a fascinating point to bring up, especially in the context of the museum. Museum collections, our mission, as you mentioned earlier, we take objects And those objects are stand-ins, really, for our understanding of the cultures from whence they came. So we really use objects to understand a whole life world, if you will. So it's I think, quite appropriate, in a way, to encounter this work as you enter the Sackler, and perhaps, we hope, be moved to at least to think or to consider the role that objects play in the way we understand culture, the way we understand people. The more tourist aspect, if you will, of not actually living amongst or being in particular places, but having representative objects teach you about them in as far or in as much as they can. And how there is a tendency, especially since the 19th century and sort of the rise of tourism, which is an important aspect, I think a strain that runs through your work, where we then use these objects to imagine.
Yeah, I think the kind of tourism that has developed in my own time is really some of it is from the internet as well. There's a kind of tourism where you find out about places. I was just talking to someone in public relations about eBay, and one of the areas that artists now do look for a specific thing is eBay, and you'll find in this particular piece, I have some smaller figurines, and they were collected from eBay Germany, and then I have some things that look jewelry-like, and they were collected from eBay India. And there are some differences in what you will find in each locale of what is being put out there in the world that represents that country. And in Germany, these dolls that are called Charlotte dolls, and the Berlin Zoo creates these little miniature animals that were fabricated in the 19th century, and then they were dug up in the soil, and so those figurines, those animals are there. But they also reflect the culture, and the culture kind of evolving out of individuals, because these little animals and figurines were not really for display, they were for playing with. They're the toys. One of the most important experiences I had with the Society of Preservation of New England Antiquities in Boston was to have the opportunity to see what are the national treasures are. It's a warehouse in Massachusetts that keeps all the presidents, all the merchants of Bostonian times, and all their belongings. And those belongings were not really always made in America. In fact, the majority of it came out of Asia, as was the trade of the time. But amongst that, what fascinated me were the dollhouses. And in the dollhouses was the stage of seeing and fabricating who you were as an American. And in them were these miniature worlds of furniture and carpets and various dolls from all over the world, what we call really the international stage of pageantry of the world. And from that, I received that idea of having miniature worlds within the larger scale sculpture.
Is there, and you've created smaller works as well. You've created more anthropomorphic figures, and here you're working large scale. What is the difference for you in working on these more contained areas and now this sort of very large cube, if you will?
Well, the scale can change quite a bit in my work. I enjoy working small. It's a very different experience working small. You have more control over it. As you make it, you can see the whole thing at the same time you're making it. When you're making larger works, your body only allows you to see the space in which you are making it, and then to see the whole is very hard. And instead of fighting that, I really rejoice in the ability to be participating in the sculpture, so to speak, because you're not in control of all of it. You're somehow part of it. And in the way that I see globalization now, I find it more interesting that we can participate in a way that we can't control all the things that are available to us. There seems to be an abundance of things. And in a very natural way, we can participate in that world if we're not in control of it, as opposed to standing away from it and seeing the whole as a cohesive, singular space.
You also have a tendency to include organic materials, and so I'm thinking of either in reference or in actual material. So you have the horns, but also the ostrich eggs.
One of the things that I love doing in my work, which is very much probably part of my generations, is, you know, I did my degree in polymer engineering, which is basically plastics. But within that education, there is a kind of history that came out of my interest in being a polymer engineer. During the 60s, the U.S. became invested in processing plastics. It became a new field of engineering. The kind of preoccupation with the synthetic is part of my generation, from wall-to-wall carpeting to new concerns in architecture and interior design for more environmentally friendly substances. I still continue to think about all that I learned in my engineering about materials. And again, this idea of splitting, which we continue to do with everything in the way we understand our world, is about forming a kind of divide between the natural and the synthetic. Of course, this is in essence a fabrication in some sense. So I really take joy in having things that are durable, lasting, but are not synthetic. And also to have this kind of tension between synthetic things, as the horns are synthetic that you see before you, but they represent the natural reproduction of an actual, at some point in its origin, a fabrication made of the original. All those conceptual things go into the work. The ostrich eggs that lie on the balance, they're real. But I do use false eggs too. And this idea of representation, which is very much part of the critical language of art history and the making of work, comes into play. What is representation? What stops representing when it is not real, when it's synthetic, when it's fabricated or reproduced? All those things feed into our not only our language, visual language, but they create different kinds of meaning and a larger vocabulary. So I'm always playing with that vocabulary.
And speaking of vocabulary, maybe I'll make this my last question so that we can open it out. Your titles. Your titles tend to carry ellipses. They sometimes wander rather long. Sometimes they're quite short. Could you talk about the way you use language?
I like to take everything seriously. The title is something I take seriously. I enjoy making the titles. I enjoy, in some sense, the title comes after I've made the piece, or sometimes in the beginning when I'm trying to conceive of the piece. And it gets edited and evolves as the piece evolves, and finally it rests in a particular place. The title is a way for me to share with the audience the text. And the text, although it appears always more exacting than the visual, which remains very suspicious, allows us to enter the work, because we share the particular language that the text is involved in. And so that access point is very important. It's also important that the text allows you to contemplate, to wonder, to bring your ideas into reading the work, to welcome the reading of the work. So the text is least of all transparent. It's always opaque, but mildly wandering. It both references the work, but also alludes to other ideas. The text in some ways allows a concrete place for you to understand that the gap is very important, the gap between knowing what the work is and embracing that the work can evolve into different things in the future, in its own history.
Wonderful. Well, maybe in opening up the language, does anyone have any questions? Yes. Sorry.
I'd like to know about the choice of red, which very much looks like blood and gives the work a sinister, like it's leaking blood or something is bleeding. Is there a reason for the red?
Yes, of course. it was one of the many things I haven't spoken about, so I'm very happy you offer it. It's a very important color, red, and it does reference the circulatory system of the body. In most obvious ways, rivers are the circulatory system that feeds the land, both in agriculture, both in terms of the animals that live on it. In some sense, if you use that kind of analogy of the body, again, as referencing the whole planet Earth, we have this circulatory system. And it lies in those fault lines that appear, and it lies because of erosion that is natural to the land. And it is the circulatory system that allows migration in its earliest form and even in the most recent kind of trajectories of mobility that allows us to have a shipping commerce. When I first saw some of the shipping ports of China, the largeness of it, like a whole cavity of a stomach that opens up like Moby Dick. It releases these large, gigantic ships that are sent out to the rest of the world. As people once were sent out, even in smaller canoes, as I see some, I remember going to a museum and seeing some of the canoes from the Tamil Nadu area that went out to Indonesia to colonize areas outside of India, and all the Greeks that went out in their boats and the Egyptians through the Nile. So all those fantasies of travel and all those possibilities of travel in water allow us to think about it in a circulatory system that not only allows us nutrition, food, but also passes the collection of objects, our possessions, to be floated down the river into the larger belly of the world, which is this ocean. For me, I always love to reference the body, whether it's the architecture of the dome itself to reference our heads, the temple, or the long trajectory of trailed objects that come off the dome into the river. This flow is always essential. And as the object that is the largest, which is that the sculpture that floats just slightly above the floor, it really refers to the fragility of our life, how it dangles on that single point of connection, which is to be alive. That connection is what that one point where the sculpture dangles like an ornament above the landscape. I think those metaphors of blood are very important. I use, again, the color red on the eggs to refer to these two rivers I have on there. One of them is the Amazon. Again, I'm referring to the rivers that have tremendous impact in the U.S. for the migration of slaves through the Congo, the slavery that is part of our history of migration as well, both forced as well as voluntary. That's, of course, my own migration, which I came with my parents, although through air and not ship. It also referenced the idea of involuntary migration in the most gentle way, which is in the arms of your parents. The red line in the eggs also references fertility. It also references the loss of life, and the egg where the shell is there and the life is no longer. The river swirls and is painted on the egg from its orifice in which the egg was extracted out. So again, a reference to the circulatory system that bleeds out.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I noticed that, you know, the work seems to be centered on rivers, but I noticed some ocean creatures as well, like the barnacles below the scales, and I'm just curious why you included those and kind of what they mean to you.
Sure. I was interested in using coral, which you find underneath the balancing scale. Corals are one of the creatures that are very affected by the climate changes. They've lost their color, we've lost coral reef, and the barnacles that continue to be a symbol of the tenaciousness of nature's wish to live, to continue as they bind themselves to ships and are constantly being removed, but they continue to come back. So for me, one is about the fragility of this coral reef that is in the ocean that is impacted by not only global warming, but also the pH, I believe, of the waters. Returning to the whole system of water that exists that sustains life in ways that we haven't even understood.
I also think it's important to note that the Himalayas, the Tibetan Plateau, the Amazon, that these are starting points, but starting points to then imagine more of a, one might even venture to say, a sort of a phenomenological geography, that this is about our more poetic and more psychological sense of geography rather than the literal sort of rivers, I think.
Yeah, I think that's very important.
Masum?
Thanks to you both for the conversation. So apologies if you answered this earlier, but I was thinking about the fact that this is situated in the space that many people sort of walk through, and I'm wondering if it was your intention that people actually meander amongst the rivers and underneath the suspended part of the sculpture as they interact with it, or if you would rather them see it on the perimeter, or both.
Well, I try to make the piece so you can, you don't necessarily have to be right underneath the piece to see everything. Mm-hmm. But of course, given the scale range, it's always difficult. And the difficulty of seeing everything that you are in front of is a reality of life. Mm-hmm. And in some sense, it's a metaphor how there are boundaries that you always experience where you can only see so much, but you know for sure that it's all there. The strain that the viewer experience when they experience a work of this size has to do with those restrictions. And even with the most easily accessible two-dimensional painting, you always feel the strain of the detail that remains elusive to your eyes and its constraints and your physical constraints with the sculpture. So rather than to see it as a burden or of trespassing, I think it's important to realize that to have an experience where you can enjoy the piece doesn't rely on seeing everything. And for me as the maker, that's definitely always true, even when I'm holding work, the work itself.
Well, I have to say, I think our registrars and conservators just breathed a huge sigh of relief on that. there, practically speaking, there is a preference to sort of stay on the perimeter because, as I mentioned at the beginning, the objects are not attached to the floor. So right. It takes one wrong step to shift the entire river. So the course of the river. So.
And as a curator, did you make a decision not to cordon it off for sort of accessibility?
Well, I think cordoning, I really dislike cordoning off because it's a physical element mm-hmm. and it really disrupts
the work,
the aesthetic on the first level, but then your bodily experience of a work, at least, you know, there's an interruption in your relationship to the work. So,
I also think it's really an important experience when you have, in this sculpture, you have a center area where there is accumulation of detail, both the balance, the eggs, what's in the next to the eggs that you have to lean over to look at. But what separates you from it is the river itself. It's always an experience where, being in Manhattan, you strain to see what's on the other side of the river, the Hudson, the East River, where you do know that there's something there, but I really do think that part of this piece is this kind of splitting that the water does, the splitting that even an ocean can do between life that lives under the ocean, life that lives on top. We always experience that in terms of boundaries, in terms of passport control, in every facet of our life. And it's very clear that when you feel like you have access to the center, you have access to power. And what separates you from that power is also an important experience that allows you sometimes more of an experience, more of an understanding of the gap rather than what's at the center.
That actually brings up an important point about installations is the ability to sort of control the body's, not control, but to influence the body's movement through a space. And so you bring up a really important point that this kind of influencing of your relationship to space, which can be a task when, in particularly in this space, not just its scale, but its physical attributes. So bravo for being able to make us think about our movement through it.
And Carol, I think you brought up an important part about my process, which I rarely anchor the smaller things and the kind of delicateness that it requires you to activate in your own body. You really have to be tiptoeing and realize this kind of relationship with the work. It's not the same experience as going to the Met and seeing a stone statue where it looms over with this kind of power over you. The large sculpture before you is also a delicate sculpture and more delicate than you are. So I think that relationship is a new experience for me, the maker, to be able to create that as a monumental piece at the same time.
Thank you very much for this very interesting conversation. And I'd like to ask you to explain some of your evolution from a polymer scientist to an artist. Or were you always an artist and decided to study polymer science?
I think one of the things I do feel about being an artist is something we all of us, whether we choose a profession of being an artist, have to have as part of our enjoyment of life. I think it allows us to really think as a platform and to receive the world. Being an artist allows me to make things with my own hands that I can share with the larger community. Being a polymer engineer, it allowed me access to science itself, which is also a global world. It's a global language. art is just beginning to be a global language. Although we've always had visual language, we've always shared the knowledge that a tree is a tree and looks like this, or maybe there is a bush, but maybe it's not a tree. And there's always been a gray area that has allowed us to think and form individual language about what is the visual and how does it play with our culture and the languages produced by culture and those differences. I think the knowledge that science sees itself, its mission, as a global language for all human beings, that it includes animals, includes everything in the universe in its interests, interested me as a an artist. And for me, the international landscape became a very important area in which I could pursue this.
I'd like to know how much of this installation was planned ahead of time and how much of it has changed since you actually started to create the work.
I think as you start to work over years and years, you know, 15, 20 years, you never can really separate one sculpture from works that you've done before, that they all speak to each other. No new piece is really that original in that sense. They're all about a journey you take and a search that you make. And so whether they really, you know, legitimately begin the moment I spoke to Carol about the commission, I can't say, because they speak to so much of my work as well, and also my experience in education. But I can't say that when I came to the project, we came about a year ago
a little over a year ago,
and so I had lots of time to think about it, but it's always never enough time. You always feel like you could spend more time on the subject because the subjects are big. They're always bigger than your ideas because the world is bigger than you, and it brings great knowledge to you to contemplate on a particular sculpture, that it always continues to give you more information after you've made it, even. So there is this kind of thread that always traces from piece to piece. Also, I think it's important to say your contact with the curator allows you to think in a way that you would not if you were making the piece alone for yourself, for your studio perhaps. The interaction of the curator is always very essential and influences the way you produce the work. So I think my conversations with Carol, her visits to my studio, understanding what Arthur Sackler wanted for his collection, coming to this museum even before I met Carol, also influenced the way I shaped the project. So in essence, it always returns as a collaboration with unknown authors.
But it's certainly, it was over a year ago, and it was quite interesting because it wasn't an idea that just sprang up a year ago. In visiting the artist, and in this case, in visiting Rena Banerjee, it was listening first to see what you were thinking about and what your ideas were, and then talking more specifically about the space or the context or even what other exhibitions might be going on, but really just hearing first what are you chewing on, essentially, and then picking up on that theme. So we try not to prescribe too much of what happens here and let it be open to the extent that our museum staff will allow us to be open and flexible, but yes.
Yeah. Well, I think different artists work in different ways, and I don't really, I've never made a drawing before a sculpture was made, but I do have very specific plans of what I'm going to use. It gets edited all the way up to the last minute to make the best piece I can. I bring all the materials to the space. Probably the person who knows the most about what I'm going to do is the person, my installer. He has all the secrets. So that person who will help me put up the work. But other than that, I really like to keep it open. In fact, it's almost as if I disclose too much in exactness, that it doesn't leave me room to edit for myself. I think it's really the hardest position to come to a space and then say, this is not working, I'm going to do it this way. You always have to be really open to that in order to make the best work, to make the most original work. There's nothing you can draw in a drawing that can really, in exactness, unless you work in a certain way where an architect, for example, would work, where they commit to a drawing, and then the drawing is just a plate in which you install. But I remain the artist throughout, so I don't take the position of, okay, the work was finished when it was drawn, and now I'm just an installer. That wouldn't be very much fun. So it always remains kind of dialogue.
I think there's an interesting balance between flexibility and actual planning, because I will say there's been, as we've talked about before, it's a sort of painting in space where you step back, you add a stroke, you step back, and elements accumulate in a certain way and in a certain arrangement. But when you got here, it was quite smooth in the sense that you knew exactly the quantities pretty close and exactly what materials you would be using, and a fabricator who also worked with you. So we're not... There was a certain amount of knowledge that was definitely organized and well-known, so that it went quite smoothly and we didn't have to run to Home Depot and buy more materials or go on eBay last night or anything like that. So there's a degree of organized imagination as well.
Say so.
Right.
Thank you, Carol and Rena. Now we can open it up for you guys to have a chance to look at the exhibition yourself, and we also have lunch available. Thank you.